run for a few minutes,
right,
and then I'll try the thing to make sure it works.
Could you want to close the door and then
maybe so.
For other noises?
Some noise, yeah. Okay, can you tell me what your position title is and such here?
The title is Field Historian of the Oregon Historical Society, which covers a multitude of sins, great many activities that I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me some of those then. How do you spend a typical week or whatever?
Well, it depends a good deal because the work can be mainly divided into about three categories, really. Research work and writing and talking, meeting with different groups, local interest groups, and historical societies and other interest groups throughout the state. So that I do quite a bit of traveling, which is, I guess is why I'm called field rather than in-house historian, because I'm out in the field quite a bit. Last Sunday, for instance, I was in Pendleton speaking at the Umatilla County Historical Society meeting. And we work closely with any historical society, local historical society, who wishes to work with us. And quite a few of the local historical societies, the county ones, are affiliated with us on a formal affiliation relationship. And one of my responsibilities is to work with them and to assist them in any way that they need. But on the other hand, we don't go in unless they ask us to come in, because we're a little bit, we're certainly aware of the Big Brother complex, and that we don't want to go in and tell them what they ought to do unless they ask for any kind of help or any kind of program or anything like that.
Okay. Well, I've done a lot of interviews on it, and it does work nicely. So a lot of this is working with the county historical societies.
And various different kinds of historical groups.
Yeah.
So quite a bit of it is traveling and meeting with people. Then the in-house activities are quite varied. For instance, I'm the editor of the OHS News, which comes out every other month, and so I do all the collecting of information for that and writing for it and getting it into print. All the activities overlap, though. For instance, as editor of the Oregon Historical Society News, I quite often use material that I've gathered while I'm out talking to the one historical society or visiting with them, because this is helpful for other historical societies. They read of something in the OHS News that another local group has done, or a problem that they have faced and worked with, and it gives them added information. So I often say that I could not possibly write a job description because there isn't any way to do it. But I do find that in the actual practical day-to-day activities, one of my activities will certainly overlap and work in well with another one.
Okay. Well, tell me about your research. What are your particular interests, or what are you doing there?
Well, my research is in sometimes it. Is an area, for instance, somebody will want me to make a speech on a certain activity, early teachers in Oregon and things like that. So I will do specific, somewhat superficial research for speeches and things like that. Then I am working on a book, actually, which is editing it. It's a journal kept by my grandmother, who came from New Argyle, New York, down across, and then across the Isthmus, and then up the Pacific Ocean to Albany to teach here. And that is a semi-professional job, because I am doing it for the Oregon Historical Society, more or less on their time, but on something that I happen, because of my circumstances, to know something about. It requires a good deal of research, however, in the library. Then general research, for instance, we're embarked on a fascinating film study, and this is something that has just come up, and we are all quite excited about it. Well, just come up, it's been going on for a couple of years now. Lou Cook, his name is Lewis Clark Cook. Isn't that a marvelous name for a man? He could do nothing else but come to work for us.
And it's L-E-W-I-S?
L-E-W-I-S,
Lewis
Clark. He
Lewis
really
Clark
was.
Cook. Okay.
And he was an early filmmaker and worked in the early days of motion picture newsreel film here with Jesse Sills and other great filmmakers. And Lou retired just recently, so he's sort of a dollar a year man here with us. And he has perfected a method of reducing that old 35 millimeter silver nitrate film that, you know, that's so terribly volatile, it goes up with a bang. Well, Lou reduces this to 16 millimeter safety film. And since he started doing that, we have found in attics and basements and garages, just reels and reels and reels of old 35 millimeter nitrate film. And Lou is reducing this. A lot of it's old newsreel film. One of the things we just did, we found some 8 millimeter film. Now we've got to blow that up.
Yeah.
Of the wreck of the Georgie Burton, which was wrecked up in the Dalles in 1948 after being taken from Portland up here. So I just finished finding out all I could about that so we could work it in and make a script about it in the film. So that the research is very practically oriented, because it's oriented toward a particular job, toward a speech or toward a book or toward working on a film script.
Okay. How does all this newsreel film happen to be around here? Why is that?
It's not around here. It's around some of the stuff we got from Seattle, as a matter of fact, from a friend of Lou's up there who knew somebody who had it, who'd heard it at someplace else. You hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
And Lou is a detective about tracking these things down. And then, of course, people will, for instance, we had a workshop seminar, which is another of my activities, to conduct, set up workshop seminars and conduct them for local historical societies. And we had one here last year on various museum activities, and some people from Lake Chelan came down from the Historical Society up there to go to the seminar. And I had asked Lou to come in and talk about his program, which he did. And they knew of some film, and they sent it down, and we copied it and made them a copy, and we have a copy for our files.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we were able to do this.
So you mentioned shipwreck and so forth. What are some of the other things on this film? What have you been finding?
We have found Lindbergh landing in Swan Island after he flew down the Columbia River and flew under the Cascade Lock Bridge of the Gods and landed here at Swan Island. Now, they tried to keep it a secret because he did not want a lot of newsreel photographers. But George Baker was mayor of Portland at that time, and he had Mrs. Wayne Coe. She's now Mrs. Wayne Coe. She was not at that time. Was a very close friend of his, known him for years, and she was an avid amateur photographer. And he took her out with him when he went out to greet Lindbergh, and she got some marvelous footage that nobody else ever had.
What year was that?
Well, let's see. It was about 1929. And then we have an old film of Mabel Strickland, who was an early cowgirl, performing in Pendleton Roundup in 1916. A marvelous old film about that. And some friends, Mr. Weatherford, who is the brother of one of our board of directors, found some old film up in Heppner of an early Heppner baseball game between Heppner and I've forgotten the other town they play. Marvelous old sandlot baseball game. Plus a jackrabbit roundup, in which they rounded up thousands and thousands of jackrabbits and then unfortunately clubbed them to death.
Which is what jackrabbit roundups end up, yes.
And as I first saw this, it's a marvelous film because you see these jackrabbits running back and forth and then you see this pile, and I was commiserating when Bill Rutherford was in my office the other day and I said I thought how horrible this was, and Bill looked at me kindly as if, you know, you're too young to know what jackrabbits really were, and he said they were just like starlings in the old days when you drove an old Model T Ford down an old country road, you frequently had to get out and club them or shoo them away so you could pass through.
Yeah. Huh. That's great.
So we found all this, and it's really fascinating.
So this is a kind of a new trove.
This is a new field we're working on now, and we're Lou and I and then Mr. Flannery, our librarian, and several other people are involved in just sort of working along with it.
Mm-hmm. How will that be available eventually?
We've made one film already called Looking Backward, and it's from these early clips. It has some nice footage of the establishment of the bridge across the Columbia River between Vancouver and Portland, and the two governors officiating at the opening, the cutting of the ribbon, with one shy little girl with a bouquet of roses, which she insists on handing to them. Really great, and parades. We found footage, reels of parades up and down the whole state of Oregon, part of Washington. We had one of Theodore Roosevelt speaking in Seattle in 1912, which somebody from Seattle sent us.
Mm-hmm.
So that the one film, Looking Backward, which is available, we loan it to our affiliate societies and rent it out to other groups. And it's done now, and it's been for a couple of years. And we're just working on a new film called Now and Forever, which will run about an hour and a half, and which is composed of more clips.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me more about your own project, your grandmother's journal.
Oh, yes. This
okay.
Is a,
tell me about the family, how they came out, and what's involved.
She came out in 1851.
What
she
was her name?
Her name was Elizabeth Miller. And that was spelled M-I-L-L-A-R, and we think now that it was just sort of a little bit of snobbishness in the family. There were too many Millers running around, and so somebody way back changed it to A-R. She was the daughter of a Presbyterian minister in New Argyle, New York, and he decided at the ripe age of about 56 to come out here to establish a mission, a Presbyterian church as a mission out here, or the church wanted asked him to, and he decided to. So she was going to come out along at the same time and teach. She was a teacher. Unfortunately, the family arrangements could not be made to send James Miller and his wife at the same time that Elizabeth came out. So she and her younger brother Frank, and she was about 23 at the time, came out themselves. Now they did it under the auspices of a Presbyterian minister and Senator Thurston, who was traveling at the same time. So they were sort of in his care. But they took a ship from New York, came down to the eastern port of the Isthmus of Canal, Isthmus of Panama, came across there on donkeys and canoes, caught the American, the ship on the other side, and came up the Pacific Ocean for Astoria and then to Portland.
That was the name of the ship that caught the American?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was. I'm not absolutely sure about that.
Yeah.
I have to go to the library and research it every time I want to know anything
what
about it.
What year was it?
1851. And so she came out with about three other teachers who were to become teachers here in Presbyterian schools. And she taught at Albany College for quite a while and then Pacific University. And then she married my grandfather, who had come out a couple of years later. His cousin was James Nesmith, who was an early senator from here and an early pioneer. So James Nesmith had suggested that my grandfather come out and he would get him his job as clerk of the Supreme Court out here. My grandfather was a young lawyer. So he did. And then later they established a judicial district, the 7th Judicial District, from east of the Cascades clear through to the border of Idaho, and that was the 7th Circuit, and he was the first judge there of that circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
So that she wrote the history she called it From the Old Home to the New, of this trip. It's a fascinating journal, in which she mentions a great many people. So what I'm doing is cutting out the things that were personal, trying to make it, and then researching for footnotes to who the people she mentions in the journal.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a little time, and I find that doing it here is always constant interruptions, and doing it at home, I just go home and go to sleep instead of doing it.
Okay.
So it's a slow process.
What age was she when she wrote the journal?
She wrote the journal in 1900, when she was, which was nearly 50 years after she made the trip.
Mm-hmm.
And she was about 75 when she wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
She died when she was about 80, about 90,
1913. Yeah. How long an account is it?
I would say just a minute. There it is, written in her own hands, and you can see what kind of a job it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
First,
to
read her handwriting, which is very good, but
yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
And then.
Now, she had followed her father out here?
No, she had come ahead of her father.
Then
he came 6 months later.
Mm-hmm.
So that she was here.
With a younger brother?
With a younger brother. Her brother was 18.
Uh-huh. How did they fend for themselves?
They came under the auspices of the Presbyterian Church. Mm-hmm. There were people here waiting to receive them. Unfortunately, her little bag of gold, her money, was given into Senator Thurston's care. And Senator Thurston died on that trip, and so there she was. He had the money, and of course it was simply he was taking care of it for her. She finally got it back, but she did arrive in Portland without any money at all. But of course, she went immediately to the home of one of the wives of the Presbyterian minister in Oregon City and stayed there until her school, the school she, it was decided which school she would go to, and then she stayed with a family there until her own parents came out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very interesting account of. She was a very courageous young woman. When they were coming up this river in Panama, she got out and swam because she felt that she'd like to bathe. And everybody else was afraid to go in the river because they were perfectly sure that there'd be crocodiles or something in there.
Yeah.
She survived very nicely.
Yeah. What are her first impressions of Oregon?
I think her first impressions were, she was terribly tired when she got there. And
what
she,
time of year was it, I wonder?
She got there in the fall, and it was raining, and she was far from home, and it took months to get any kind of communication back and forth. And she felt extremely lonely at first. That it was a great adventure and that she was looking forward to it, but miserable
mm-hmm.
at times.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very frank about it, but she also was very excited about the things that were going to happen to her. Unfortunately, within a couple of years after they lived here, and they lived at Albany, and her father built this house in an octagon shape. I think there's a picture of it or a drawing of it in there. He was killed in the explosion of the Gazelle, an old steamship going up the Willamette River. It blew up. Boiler blew up.
Her father.
And shortly after he established his ministry here, and he was killed.
So that left her entirely?
So that left her mother. But by that time, she was engaged to marry Joseph G. Wilson and did later marry him and established a home in Salem and then later in the Dalles when he was a circuit judge there.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother lived with him a good deal of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very interesting account. And then she was a fascinating woman. Joseph G. Wilson was elected to Congress and went back to take his seat, and she went with him. They went back to their family home in Marietta, his family home in Marietta.
Ohio.
And he was to deliver the graduation address at the college there. He was an alumnus of it, and died the night before of an unexpected heart attack, just after he'd taken his seat in Congress. He was only 47 years old. And she came back to the Dalles and was appointed postmistress, was the first woman postmistress, U.S. postmistress, and was postmistress in the Dalles for years and years.
Is that right? Huh. Never remarried?
Never remarried.
Mm-hmm. So, and your mother grew up over in the Dalles?
That was my father's mother.
Well, that was
and,
your father's
yeah,
mother, yeah.
And he grew up in the Dalles and later became circuit judge there too, so he followed in his father's footsteps.
Uh-huh.
So I suppose that's one of the reasons why I'm here at the Oregon Historical Society.
Yeah. Yeah. You've seen pictures of her?
Oh, yes. Yes, so I have several pictures of her. She's a very forceful-looking, very attractive woman in her younger years. In her older years, she looks exactly like Queen Victoria. She has that same sort of pugnacious look, and I imagine that she was. I never knew her. She died long before my mother and father were married. But I named for her, and she's an interesting person in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this must be quite a project of love.
Yes, it is. That's the octagon house he built.
Okay, why did he build an eight-sided house?
I have no idea. And nobody else does either. Uh-huh. And I guess that he was the kind of man that you didn't ask. But it's a difficult house to build, and
mm-hmm.
I should have thought it would have cost him a great deal more money than your ordinary block house. But he did.
The only other one I can think of offhand that I've encountered in photos is up at Metlakatla, Alaska, Father Duncan built.
And it certainly wasn't like their house in New Argyle that they came from, so it wasn't an attempt to recreate the old homestead.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He just did it.
Yeah. Were they Scottish?
Originally, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they were Nesmith. He wasn't because my father was Nesmith, but they were Scottish too.
Mm-hmm. Now, the house, I suppose, is.
No, it's no longer standing. It's been torn down.
Yeah.
It was in Albany for. I think they tore it down in the early 20s, so it didn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did you say she taught in Albany?
She taught at Albany College, which no longer exists,
mm-hmm.
which actually became Lewis and, was moved and became Lewis and Clark College.
Uh-huh.
But it was in Albany, and then she taught at Pacific University in Forest Grove.
Mm-hmm. Was that Presbyterian?
Yes.
Role? Mm-hmm. And taught at Pacific also.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And then married Joseph G. Wilson and
mm-hmm.
didn't teach anymore. But mm-hmm. then did become postmistress after he died.
Lived in Dallas until she died, did she?
She lived in the Dallas until she died.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And,
it really was unusual to have a woman post or have a postmistress, wasn't it?
Yeah. She didn't have any money at all after her husband died, and she had at that time my father, who was 6 months old, and two older sons and four daughters. So she brought them all back to the Dalles, and friends intervened with President Grant, who was president at that time, and in 1875, I think, she was appointed U.S. postmistress, and continued there, kept in her house, which was down right near the waterfront, right near the Umatilla Hotel on the Dalles, and she turned the front living room into the post office. And the children all helped sort mail and things like that.
Yeah.
So it was a family. Well, you couldn't do it nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it
right.
evidently worked out. And it allowed her to have a job and to make some money and to still live at home and take care of her children.
Okay.
I believe she did teach for a year after she came back. And her oldest daughter stayed home and took care of the children, which wasn't a very good. And so then she became postmistress, and friends helped her get the appointment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, are you going to hang on to the title from the old?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how she came to write this?
Yes, she wrote it for my father and her children when she was 90 years old, or no, she was 75 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And she, of course, she's looking back after a 50-year gap, but her memory was remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As well as her handwriting. It's really very easy to read once you get into
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah, this really isn't bad at all.
they taught handwriting in school, and
yeah.
you know, that's Spencerian hand, and you just...
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That was one of the things that you had to do to become, to graduate, to become an accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
But it's been a very interesting thing. As I say, I wish it would move faster, but
yeah.
Life is pretty hectic here at the Society, and this is the sort of thing I'm doing when I have an hour, uninterrupted hour, which doesn't happen very often.
Well, how are you fortunate enough that this has been passed along to you?
She made four copies of it. This was my father's copy, and so I have, my brother and I share it. And he's a judge too, so he's very interested in this. And then the other three copies went to her three surviving daughters, and they still exist. My cousin has one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is our copy. But she wrote it four times.
Yeah, yeah. Now this is a kind of what would you call this book? It's a notebook of its time, I
yes.
guess. Let's see. About 6x9.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are about 80 pages in it,
uh-huh.
something like that, in her
mm-hmm.
handwriting.
Okay.
So
well,
I don't know how long,
yeah.
how much it will make when we
yeah.
work it out.
Hmm.
But it's interesting.
Yeah, right. Well, what about the other side of your family then?
My mother's family came from South Dakota and came out here in the 1880s. So they were. Somewhat later, and her father farmed in the Dalles area for a long time, and she taught too. She's a teacher in the Dalles, and met my father there, and they were married. And her family came originally from also from New England, so that both sides of the family came from New England.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We often kid her family because her family came slowly and surely westward, and. A little at a time. My father's family, the Wilsons, left Londonderry under a cloud because this was in 1812 when they moved to Marietta, Ohio. One of their members, Pinkerton Wilson, was a medical student, and he and three other medical students decided to eliminate the middleman in searching for their own cadavers and were caught grave robbing. And of course, you can imagine what that did to the family. They did a very interesting thing. They the four families involved, Pinkerton, the Wilsons, and three other families, got together and sold everything they had and put up bail so to get their sons out of jail. And they, to them, it was such a tremendous scandal. Of course, nowadays, I suppose we'd more or less laugh at it. But then it was a very, very tragic occurrence, and they all moved. They left New England, and ARP did, the Wilsons moved to Marietta, Ohio in 1812.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, you have a lot of history and known to you.
Yes. Luckily, like so many families, we had one aunt who did everything, except she nearly stopped her research when she found that she had a grave robber in the family. It always amused my father terribly.
Was she doing genealogy?
She was doing genealogical research until she came across Pinkerton, and then that cooled her ardor a good deal.
Okay. Well, how about you? How long have you been with the Historical Society?
I've been here 5 years now. I was had been in California, although I was born and raised, of course, in Oregon, and then came back to Oregon in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
I was living in the Bay Area, and I was divorced, and so the children and I came back here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's your background in education? Where did you go to school?
I graduated from Whitman College with a BA in English Literature, and then got a master's degree at San Francisco State in English and American Literature, so that my background is literary rather than historical, because I had a minor in history, and this gradually came about, I think, the interest.
Mm-hmm.
I taught English Literature.
Oh, where was that?
Catherine Branson School in Ross, California.
Oh.
It's a girls' preparatory school. And then when I decided to come back to Oregon, I thought I'd probably teach here. I had a master's, but not a general secondary. So when I came back to Oregon, I went to Portland State to get my general secondary, and then did some volunteer work here, and this job came up, and I decided I'd had enough of grading freshman English exams, so this is much more fun.
Okay. Well, when you're out talking to these groups, what kind of things come up? Do they pop questions on you?
Quite a bit. Two general areas, I think. If I talk to the historical societies, their concern and the things that they want to talk about usually are what can we do to get more members? It's a practical approach. Occasionally, they will want me to talk on history of their area. But mostly, I go out to the historical societies as sort of a journeyman plumber to come out and talk to them about what they can do to either get more members or get more money or publish a quarterly or a newsletter or something like that. When I talk to teacher's honorary educational group, made a couple of speeches to them, and educational sororities, and they wanted talks about early teachers, and I think called the title of the speech Pioneer Pundits. And then I have talked to the Sons and Daughters of the Oregon Pioneers. They wanted to talk on early navigational, and I remember I'd go to the Dallas Lions Club and talk about navigation on the Hickson and the river there. And so it depends. If it's another kind of a group, then it's a topic speech.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a historical group, usually it's a practical speech.
Mm-hmm.
It's a how-to speech.
Now, Oregonians seem very history conscious to me.
They are, and I don't know whether that's a part of Oregon's, or whether more everybody's becoming more history conscious now. Do you think so?
Well, to some extent, I guess, but it seems to me that you have more active, say, county societies.
We do. We have almost every county in Oregon has a county historical society.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there are, for instance, the French Prairie Historical Society, which is a group in Woodburn, formed to save and use the Settlemar House, which is a beautiful early house down there, and now are just a general historical society. That is their chief project, but they also are interested in the history of the area. There's the Silverton Historical Society. In Salem, there's no really strong Marion County Historical Society, but there must be about 20 local historical societies in Marion County.
Hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know whether this is Oregon. Of course, my theory about so much of the settlement of Oregon, of course, it came from two places, New England and Missouri. There was a big Missouri migration, and then there was New England where my family came from. And, you know, the great influx into California was Gold Rush. And to a certain extent, the influx into Washington was Gold Rush on to the Yukon. But except for a very, very small flurry of gold up in Baker County, which went out fast, your majority of people came to Oregon to farm and to stay right there. And I think that there's more of the interest, because they were kind of people who were interested in roots where they were, and are simply transplanted, and had that little yearning for either Missouri or New England or points in between.
Have you ever done anything on the Oregon Trail stuff?
Yes,
you know?
We've done a good deal on the Oregon Trail. We have a series of slides we have taken. One of the things we do, which is quite interesting, is to take our old, some of our old photographs, and we've got a massive old photograph collection, which is really fascinating. In fact, we're in the process of cataloging. We had to wait till we got funded, and we're making a union catalog now, but it's taking 3 years. But we've taken some of those and made slideshows from them. Since we have a slideshow of neighborhoods in Portland, we've got a slideshow of the Oregon Trail, some of the early photographs and also some late photographs showing some of the trail markings still there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Applegate Trail, too, which came in over at Southern Oregon.
Yeah.
I took a... It's another one of my functions. Once a year, we have what we call a Trapper's Rendezvous, and we select some historic spot in either Oregon or Washington. We went up to Fort Simcoe 3 years ago, and we take about 2 busloads. Usually, we can't, just for logistics, we can't take more than 2 busloads because we go to a place where there aren't accommodations. We went to Lakeview 2 years ago, and 2 busloads really took care of everything. Accommodation they had in Lakeview, but we went to Lakeview and down to watch the Applegate Trail, and you can still see tracks coming over. And we went over Fandango Pass and Fort Bidwell in California, and then back. This is a fascinating thing. We have people that go on this every year.
I was going to say, who goes?
Well, it's open to our members, and we send out a membership letter and on first come first serve, and we fill up the buses in about 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just take off.
Yeah.
And there's a total price for the trip. I go a month before, I make a dry run and go and find out the accommodations and talk to the local people. And usually a local historical society then entertains us when we're there and puts on a banquet or something. In Lakeview, they put on a pioneer breakfast and they had out the fairgrounds for us, had steaks and potatoes and bottles of bourbon, which they just passed around. Everybody took a swig at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. True pioneer breakfast.
Yeah, true pioneer breakfast. It was great. So we have, you know, various adventures like that, and it's a marvelous trip.
Uh-huh.
We have a great many repeaters that go every year,
yeah.
Which is very nice for me because I've got the old standby, so I know if anybody gets... If we have a problem, we have the whole people that have gone for 3 or 4 times.
Yeah. Now, you grew up in the Dalles,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay. When were you born there?
I was born there in 1921, lived
mm-hmm.
there, and...
Till when?
Until I went to... lived there constantly until I went to college, and then after I went to college, I worked in San Francisco until my marriage
mm-hmm.
in 46, and...
Well, what was the Dalles like then through the 20s and the Depression, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I can remember when the banks closed in the Dalles, and what was it, 32, wasn't it, in October? No,
33.
33,
yeah.
October 33. And I was going to have a Halloween party that my parents told me we'd have, and I could have my little friends, and the banks closed, and we couldn't have the Halloween party. That's the chief memory of the Depression. Couldn't have that Halloween party.
A 12-year-old,
you know. Who cares about unemployment lines and everything?
Yeah.
But the George Johnson Bank in Duford was a small local bank, and George Johnson was a good friend of my father's, and so we always banked there instead of the banks in the Dalles. which was no problem. You could cash checks any place. Anyway, but George Johnson refused to close his bank when Roosevelt issued the edict that all banks would take a bank holiday, and he kept his bank open. A fact of which he was very proud in later years. Of course, the fact I don't think anybody was going to bother sending out the federal troops to Newford to close George Johnson's bank, but in fact, he did keep it open, which was very nice because we could still get our money out and deposit our checks.
Yeah. Was that the name of his bank?
Yeah, George Johnson Bank in Newford.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see, but what was the size of the Dalles in those days?
The Dalles in those days, 6,000 to 7,000. Well, 12,000 now, I suppose, but it was a very small, sleepy little town, a lot of history in it, because, of course, in the early days, it was one of the main stops on the river, and the Umatilla House there was the outstanding hotel all up and down the Columbia River. My father wanted nothing so much as to be on the river. He loved it, and that's one of the boats that a friend of his modeled from him, and he wanted to be, so when he graduated from John Hopkins, he came home and went down and got a job as a purser and spent a wonderfully happy year as a purser on some of the old steamboats, old sternwheelers, until his mother, who, as I told you, was quite a dominant person. One day, Dad went down and the boss of the said, well, you aren't working here. Didn't you know your mother came down yesterday and resigned for you? So he became a lawyer.
This turned him into the
well, law. He knew he had to be sooner or later. He was, I think, just enjoying himself until he did. He loved the law, and it worked out much better for him because he was an honorary steamboat man all his life. He would go to the steamboat men's conventions at Champlain and make a speech and talk to all his friends. So he was much more used to the steamboat men as judges than he would have been as a purser.
Yeah. Let's see, how long did the steamboats run?
They ran, they have spurts. Dad wrote a little book called The Lure of the River, which the Oregon Historical Society has published under the title Steamboats on the Columbia, and there's a copy of it down there in the bookcase, and tells about the various spurts of activity on the river, which really started in the early 1840s, 50s, and 60s, then dropped down when the railroads came, then came again as a most inexpensive way of transporting wheat and gold and things like that. But the passenger traffic fell off, of course, after the railroads came in. When I was a very small girl, I remember my father made sporadic attempts to have passenger steamboats and freight steamboats between Portland and the Dalles, and they did indeed for a little while, but it didn't work. But the old Georgiana used to run from Portland to Astoria. It was a day ship, and our family trek used to be to Portland, and then on the Georgiana to the coast, and then back up the Georgiana to Portland, pick up our car, and drive back to the Dalles.
This is a kind of an annual trip?
This was an annual summer trip.
Ah, what years would that have been?
When I was just a baby, 1925, 26, on up to about early 1930s.
Is that a day trip down to Astoria?
It was a day trip from Portland to Astoria. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful ship, boat. It had no staterooms, though. Now, the boat, the Dalles City and the Bailey Gatzert and the Harvest Queen all had lovely staterooms. Georgiana didn't, and it was a very much faster boat, very slim. Beautiful thing.
Hmm.
And made the trip.
It was a sternwheeler?
Yeah, it was a sternwheeler.
Hmm. Yeah. Let's see, Georgiana is spelled...
George, I-A-N-N-A. Yeah, Georgiana.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I'm sure it was that it ran as far as the early 30s because I can remember it myself, not just hearing about it.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking back over your grandmother's tourist postmistress, long run of Republican, she was able to hold a job for a long time, wasn't she?
I suppose that was, she was a good Republican,
yeah.
And I think that was part of it.
Yeah.
And her husband had been Republican congressman.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what would have happened. If
years of Republican president.
Actually, I think that's when, the first, who would be the Democratic president around 1900?
Well, Cleveland.
It was when Cleveland came in, that I think she had reached the age where she wanted to retire anyway,
so, yeah.
And they wanted to appoint a new postmistress, so it was an amicable party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she had rather an interesting career. She was a very dominant woman, I understand, of course, I say it. But it's interesting that my father and mother did not get married until a year after she died.
Right.
And they were married late, fairly late in life.
Take it that she lived with your father?
He lived with her.
He lived with her.
Okay. So to say that it's fraught for the psychiatric field, my brother and I often wonder, you know, why we're still upright.
And she and your grandmother built a home there?
Yes, they built a house on Union Street, which then was the post office for quite a while. And I was born there, as a matter of fact. Then they tore the thing down. And we owned the house for a long time. Dad finally sold it, but it was a great big old house down on, just as I say, right close to the Intel House and close to the port, so that it was very convenient to turn into a post office.
Mm-hmm. What about other material coming into the society, such as do you have a constant flow of that kind of stuff?
This I was doing particularly because about 6 months ago in the newsletter, we asked for people to send in, to make out family questionnaires, and we wrote a little structure about what we would like from their experiences, their family's experiences and their own experiences, clear up to what were you doing when they first landed on the moon, that sort of thing. And we got a marvelous amount of material in, which we are going to have in our libraries for people who would like to do or research into tone and mood as well as factual accounts, how people felt about things, because that's part of what we do in our library. And
now, what groups did this?
Just anybody that it went to our membership. See, our newsletter is mailed automatically to our members every other month, and in the newsletter, we asked for people to consider doing this. We got some very interesting material back in, which then, of course, we are always getting collections of material. And from people who really want it preserved, and either you're going to get one of your you have three children, you don't know how to divide it, so you give it to the Oregon Historical Society, and you know it will be preserved there. Material as well as artifacts.
Mm-hmm. Are you ever offered stuff when you're out on your speaking tours?
Yes, quite often, which is of course one of the things that we like to have happen. Mm-hmm. I'll be talking to somebody. And they'll say, well, we have this, would the Historical Society be interested in it? Heavens yes, you know, bring it in. We do have to be a little careful when I'm talking to county historical societies, because some of the things really should belong there, stay in the county, and we don't want to be the huge hog sitting here and bringing it all in. But on the other hand, some of the things should belong here as a central repository. They're always available to county historical societies. Pictures and things, we should have at least a copy of any picture. And we do.
Mm-hmm. Do you have some book coming up beyond this one? Do you have another field of interest? Or is this going to do it?
No, this is going to do it for a little while. When I get through with this, I'll worry about the next one. We do my doing the newsletter, which runs from anywhere from 4 to 8 pages every month, takes a good deal of time, plus book reviews for the quarterly and things, and writing pamphlets, writing funding application grants.
You do that too?
Yeah, I do that too, although I would like to see us develop a development office and somebody do that entirely, because as it stands now, that's an art in itself,
mm-hmm.
and I don't give enough time to it.
How is the grant situation now?
Well,
is there much money available?
Or? There's from private foundations, there's more. The two great grants for are the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts. And if you have a regional program, then you have possibilities of getting money. But if you have a local program, then no. The Oregon Committee for the Humanities, which is a re-grant structure, they receive grant money from the National Endowment for the Humanities and re-grant. And I think Washington has one, too. I know they do.
Yeah,
there you can get grants for local projects that address itself only to the state or only to a part of the state. But that has to have a public policy issue involved in it. And so we've got to bring a public policy issue into a historical field. We did it. We had a marvelous program funded by the Oregon Committee for the Humanities in which we We call it our Bicentennial Brown Bag Lunch and Lecture Series, and I was in charge of that, and it was one of the most, it was time consuming, but it was one of the most rewarding things I think I've done in a long time. We set up a series of re-examination of the Bill of Rights 200 years later, what the context in which these particular 10 amendments were first introduced, how they worked through the years and how they're working now, and whether there is any change in the understanding of them and in the explanation of them. And we got scholars from throughout the state, Professor Hans Lind from the University of Oregon Law School, who has just been appointed to the Oregon Supreme Court, Judge Diaz and Judge Abatey from here, quite a few humanists and scholars, and each one came and talked on a specific aspect of it. We divided First Amendment into four specific lectures, because you're covering the freedoms, and then the last two we lumped into one, because the rights that are delineated, the rights that are reserved to the state. But out of that we had 16 specific different lectures, running 16 consecutive Thursdays, and we provided coffee, and people, it was a specifically addressed to the downtown community, lunch hour. Bring your lunch, come over, listen to this, have a discussion, talk about it. And it was really fascinating. I got so involved in it, I wouldn't miss one of those for the world.
Yeah. And, on your, let's see, how much are you out speaking?
I'd say about this month I made 3 trips outside. One to Champoig, one to Salem, and one to Pendleton. That's, I think, probably about.
Have you pretty much been across the state by now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Burns. Last year in December, I went to Harney County.
County.
In December.
Talk about history, Harney County.
Yeah. And yes, pretty much around the state, which is I just love because, last month October I went down to. Coos and Curry County, and took all the back roads I could find, and so you learn so much more about the state when you're, and I usually drive.
What kind of folks do you meet out there, too? Is there a lot of interest, say, from a guy who'd be a retired lumberjack or a cowboy?
Yeah, all sorts of different kinds of people that are interested, and one of the nice things that I'm just delighted about, they aren't all senior citizens, older people. There are a lot of younger people who are interested in history. In Coos County, the new vice president, no, in Curry County, the new vice president is a young secretary at school in one of the school districts. And a lot of teachers, of course, you would expect that, but an awful lot of people in trades, in business, small businesses, farming, that are interested in not only their own history, but the general history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just neat, I think, that the more of that.
Yeah.
So that, and I like it, because I like meeting people and meet all sorts of different.
Is the society doing any oral history?
Yes, not as much as we'd like. That's a program that should get a lot going. We're working with other groups, however, who are also doing it. We have a young man, Charles D. Gregorio, who is an urban historian, that's his title now, and unfortunately he's on CETA funds with us, and we don't know how much longer that lasts, or whether we can get some funds so we can continue him, as we wish to do. But again, we're hampered by, we only have so much equipment, and we only have Charlie and some volunteers, and you know, the problem of getting out, recording, taping somebody, getting back, getting a transcript typed up. We're doing it little by little.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, when you do oral history, time is of the essence. You have the feeling that the Grim Reaper's right behind you, and if you don't get somebody this week, next week may be too late. Several others, the Jewish Historical Society is doing a very interesting, Shirley Tanzer's doing a good oral history program. Quite a few of the local groups. Burns is doing one of the most fantastic oral history programs I've ever seen, and I'm just delighted. Claire Luce,
The town of Burns?
Yeah, the town of Burns, Oregon.
Yeah.
It's got one of the best oral history programs in Oregon.
Is that right?
Yeah. They were funded by it, by a private grant made by the, I think she was, I'm not quite sure, she's either the niece or the daughter-in-law of Henry Luce Tyne. She came from Burns. And she, because it's called the Luce Fund, and it was either given by her or in her memory to Burns for this specific program. They have an oral historian there. The last time I visited them, they showed me this. They have tapes of everybody in the county, practically. They have a transcript of each tape, photographs in the transcript that they were able to get, so that you have in the library, and it's all available in the Harney County Library. You have the tape, you have the transcript with some photographs usually, and it's cataloged as to person who did it, person who was interviewed, and subject. Mm-hmm. So it's easily retrievable.
Do you know who's running that over there?
Yes, Pauline Brayman. And I can find her name and address for you. I think it's Breyman. I'm not sure.
I'll
get it after you turn it off. Yeah. And she is doing just an outstanding job.
Hmm. Yeah.
But isn't it funny to find, she's doing a better job than we are.
Yeah.
Simply because they have the funds and we have to use volunteers to transcribe, and that's not always successful.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to try to do some writing about the British Columbia
Are you?
Program.
Yes, they're doing some outstanding work there too.
Of course, I don't know what the new regime up there, whether they're funding like the former regime did or not. But
I don't either, but that former regime in funding the Dominican museum there.
Yeah.
That museum is
it's
just incredible.
Yeah.
And that was all done with government money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Not one private cent in that. Of course, we're just a quasi-state institution. We go down to the state legislature every year, and we get, or every biennium, we get an appropriation, but we never know how much it's going to be.
Yeah.
It's always less than we ask for and more than we think we should have.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but besides that, we are funded entirely by membership. So we're always working on projects with just, working to get the funds for the project.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
If we were a state institution, we might have more money, but then on the other hand, we couldn't do the things we want to do as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have an assistant? Are you your office and yourself?
I'm my office. Well, I have some typing help and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and filing, but I'm it.
Okay. Well, I think that pretty well covers it for me, if I could get some of your newsletters.
Yes,
and
let me give you some.
Pauline Brayman's address.
Yeah, great.
Up.